You guys have been huge, huge supporters of Children's Health Defense, coming to our conferences, supporting us, speaking at those conferences and such. CHD is going to be in the house on the 2nd through the 4th as well, too. Mary Holland is going to be attending the conference. Dr. Liz Mumper is one of the confirmed presenters to be there, along with an amazing, amazing group of medical professionals. I want to start first by just talking about this title here, Healthcare Revolution, Restoring the Doctor-Patient Relationship. Why don't one of you go ahead, pick which one. Talk to us a little bit about that title.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you know, the healthcare system is broken. COVID has shone a bright light on this, and we've recognized how broken the system is. And so the purpose of our conference is really to restore trust in medicine, to inspire people, and basically to, to impassion them that they can take control of their own life and control of their own healthcare, and that they need to be empowered. So it's really a conference of empowerment, inspiration, and people, like-minded people getting together. I think that's what people really enjoy the most is, they amongst people they can relate to, people they can talk to, and people who they can understand. And so that's the premise of the meeting. It's not a protest meeting. It's a getting together meeting. It's a positive meeting. It's what we can do to be proactive to improve the healthcare of our patients. Pierre, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think you articulated well. I mean, I like that Paul said, it's not a contrarian conference where we point out all the flaws. I mean, we're really looking for solutions, and we're looking to kind of build a place or a community where both providers and patients, or what we call health enthusiasts, can congregate to get unconflicted information, exchange ideas. I like that you like the title, Michael, because, restoring the doctor-patient relationship, that is what it's about. I think right now the view of the population towards the average doctor, at least in my circles, after seeing and learning what we have in COVID, is quite negative. And I think it's not only the doctor's fault. I mean, the system has turned into this top-down oppressive system where these bureaucrats that are oftentimes almost always conflicted are given guidance, and it's becoming more rigid, the use of protocols. And, we have a system that's almost entirely based on pricey patented pharmaceutical products. One thing that Paul and I have learned on this journey is the wealth of health interventions and, treatments that are not profitable to the pharmaceutical industry, and that are really quite safe and quite effective. And so we want to restore the freedom not only to physicians so they can learn more about what's being kept from them and what they're being prevented from using, and as well as connect them, connect patients with providers and give patients guidance. And so, the medicine's been eroded, I would say slowly over decades and really rapidly over COVID. And we want to set an example for the way it should be. And I think we're going to do a good job of that.
Oh, I hope you'll be joining us at the conference. It will be inspiring. Our doctors love nothing better than to solve problems that make a patient's life better, healthier. It's going to be a celebration of the kind of medicine that focuses on good health, not on selling pills or pushing shots or whatever else they're pushing. Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. If you were here for the first time, and we suspect a number of you are, if you heard about tonight's webinar for the, because you saw our Dr. Merrick on television earlier this week, interviewed by Jen Jeffcoat, and you came here to learn more, you are in the right place. It's and a special welcome to you. We're happy to have you here. I'm Betsy Ashton. I'm creative director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals, and this regular weekly program is your place to learn about emerging health topics, ask questions directly of some of the most open-minded and experienced medical professionals in the country, and meet up with other people on a similar health journey. say hello in the chat, and use the Q&A to ask questions of our nurses who are already on behind the scenes, and they will answer questions that you text into Q&A, and the doctors as well, because I'm going to bring some of those questions forward after our doctors finish the discussion of the main topic this evening. And let me tell you, we've got a really good topic that you might care a lot about, whether it's for yourself or your parents or grandparents or someone else that you love. You know, who knew that fasting could benefit brain health? Well, our Dr. Paul Marek is going to be here talking with our favorite neurologist, Dr. Suzanne Gazda. She can tell you, and he can get into this too, because he's had a personal experience with fasting recently, why this is so important. It's something we can each do for ourselves that can benefit our health and really matter. Prevent Alzheimer's, dementia, eliminate brain fog. Let's get into it. Doctors, come on out here. And, you know, I want to know more.
Thank you, Betsy. It's good to see Dr. Gazda here. And I'm wearing my bomber jacket. I was pressurized into wearing it, so it's as warm as heck inside. Anyway, so I'm going to just start off talking about what intermittent fasting is, or time-restricted feeding. And then we're going to talk about, you know, brain health, because as Dr. Gazda would explain, promoting brain health has become a really important issue. So the problem with most Western people is they eat all the time. They snack, they eat, and that's not the way we are. You know, we have evolved to eat. You know, our forefathers ate one or two meals a day, and then they fasted in between. Westerners and Western diet, basically, people are eating all the time. And as we'll see, this is a very unhealthy way of eating. So intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, basically what it involves is to eat within a particular window during the day. So this could be a window anywhere from 2 to 10 hours. So you eat during that window, and then the rest of the time you don't eat, you fast. So you can drink lots of fluid, that's fine, but you don't eat. And it's very important in terms of maintaining metabolic health and maintaining brain health. And this is the way the body was actually designed. This is the way we were designed to eat. One of the most important attributes of intermittent fasting is it promotes a process called autophagy or autophagy. And this is the way the cell cleans out cellular debris by this process of autophagy. And the most effective way of activating autophagy or autophagy is intermittent fasting. But as we'll see, and as Dr. Gazda will talk about, it's very important for brain health. It's very important for metabolic health. It's the most effective way of treating insulin resistance and diabetes. It's the most effective way of losing weight and maintaining weight loss. This should not be considered a diet. This isn't a diet. This is a lifestyle change. And it's very flexible. So you can adapt this dietary pattern to your lifestyle, whatever that may be, and it's very flexible. So depending on your work, home situation, it can be adapted to what you're doing. So, you know, we'll take some more questions towards the end, but that's just a brief overview of intermittent fasting and how important it is for promoting metabolic health. And with that, Dr. Gazda, do you want to tell us why it's so important and why promoting brain health has become such a major priority?
Oh, yes. First of all, thank you for asking me to be here tonight, and welcome to everybody that's on listening to this presentation. I could not agree more. That I always say the road to better brain health, the top two things are healthy diet and intermittent fasting. So eat good food, maybe eat a little less food. And you know, I read recently, Paul, that about 40% of the population, it may be higher than that, but has insulin resistance, and even young individuals. So the intermittent fasting is, as you mentioned, a great way to get our metabolic health back in order. Now, back to the question about why today it's more important than ever to focus on brain health. And it has to do with one of our most covered topics, and that is COVID and the pandemic measures. You know, when you look at studies across the board, cognitive impairment is the thing everybody's talking about. And it's a very burdensome problem, obviously. The studies show that it's anywhere from people that recovered from COVID. Of course, if you were hospitalized, your outcome is going to be worse. But even people like us that got COVID and got better, the range of cognitive impairment is anywhere from 18 to 80%. And there was a shocking study recently published in European Neuropsychology. And what they showed is that a year after recovering from COVID, these weren't people complaining of anything wrong with their memory. They found that over 40% of them had abnormalities on their neuropsych testing. Let me give you another example. Medical students. There's a study done in medical students, and they looked at medical students that had COVID and those that didn't have COVID. Of course, they weren't hospitalized. I don't know how they found the ones that didn't have COVID, but anyway, what they found, and none of the students were reporting any cognitive impairment, but what they found in the ones that had had COVID was a profound abnormality in their auditory processing. So ability to learn, ability to remember, remembered how to give orders. It's very concerning, right? So what I'm trying to say is that we're all at risk to cognitive decline since 2020. Whether we got COVID, whether we got the COVID vaccine, because it is related to lingering viral fragments, especially spike protein. And the brain seems to be especially vulnerable, especially the memory centers, the hippocampus, which is the primary memory center, the gray matter, where 90% of your neurons are. So I am concerned, and I'm seeing it in my practice, more and more people, even young individuals, presenting with complaints that their brain doesn't work. The other concerning thing is if you look at studies that are studying cognitive COVID, is what it's called, many times the patients are not getting better. So we have to implement brain recovery protocols, implement brain health prevention protocols, and then I think we can avoid this epidemic of Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia that is certainly headed our way. I believe Alzheimer's disease should be a rare disease, and it certainly is a preventable one, and it certainly is a treatable one, but not with the pharmaceutical drugs. Big Pharma has spent $46 billion over the last few decades trying to find an Alzheimer drug. We don't have a drug for Alzheimer's drug. And just like we've said about other things, there'll never be one thing that helps this problem, which is why we have to structure our lifestyle in a way as our best first line defense. And so I love that. I like the intermittent fasting, the healthy diet, of course, low inflammatory diet. Mediterranean diet is a good example. And I think I'm going to say, I think we have to eat, try to avoid toxins like glyphosate. And if we can afford it, I always say maybe we can't afford not to, is eat non-GMO, grass-fed beef, free-range chicken, et cetera. Those are key steps to lowering inflammation.
So could you explain to us how intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding actually improves brain function? Because I think it's a critical piece. And, you know, it's a very simple intervention to do. You know, once you adapt it to it, it's very easy. And it seems to have a, you know, pretty profound effect on brain function. Do you want to maybe go into a little bit of an explanation for us?
I see it all the time. I remember a long COVID patient recently that I was treating for cognitive impairment. She's overweight, you know, really likes her carbs and sugar. And so I said, well, just try this. Just do this. Try to clean up your diet. And I was shocked. A month later, she came back and she said, gosh, my brain just, I can think so much more clearly. So the way intermittent fasting helps the brain is it does a few things. Of course, it lowers inflammation. As you said, it upregulates autophagy, which I think is such a funny word. Essentially, autophagy is the garbage truck coming to clean up stuff that we don't need or want anymore. And neurons, the brain, is extremely vulnerable to when autophagy starts to shut down. And we know spike protein shuts down autophagy, increases cell senescence. And we know as we age, autophagy is dysregulated and decreased. So it upregulates autophagy. It increases a wonderful protein in the brain called BDNF. It stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And we want more BDNF produced. Exercise will increase it, but intermittent fasting will as well. And if you have increased BDNF, that can increase synaptic connections. Your neurons just interact better together. And it helps with neurogenesis, the formation of new neurons. When I was in medical school, we were taught that the brain, once you got what you got, and there was no chance that the brain could recover or develop new neurons. But we know that's not true, and that BDNF is part of neuroplasticity and restoration. So to me, those are some of the key mechanisms and how intermittent fasting can be vastly helpful for the brain. Of course, restores metabolic health. Insulin resistance is a big part of dementia because insulin is a growth factor for the brain. And when we become resistant to insulin, not only does it increase our risk of developing diabetes, but we lose another growth factor that helps us to restore neurons.
What about the circadian resynchronization? That seems to be a really interesting thing. So it seems that most people who have early dementia lose their circadian synchronizations, which is such, seems to be such an important thing. And that intermittent fasting seems to resynchronize all your biological clocks. And so all your genetic material becomes resynchronized. And it seems to be a very important factor in dementia.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up. There was that study in cell metabolism. It was a mice study. And most of the studies in intermittent fasting, quite frankly, are animal studies. But yeah, the mice that were placed on an intermittent fasting regimen, they were fed the same food, right? But the ones with the intermittent fasting had better cognitive effects and had decreased abnormal pathological proteins like amyloid and tau. And what was surprising to me about that study is how quick the turnaround was, how quickly they saw benefits. So yes, that as well probably is major in influential.
So, you know, I think that brain health should be something that we all should consider in our daily lives, just because I think, you know, the concept or the problem of cognitive decline as we age, you know, portends a very poor quality of life. And most of us would rather have, you know, we were more interested in health span than lifespan. So I think most of us would want to have a, you know, healthy, productive life in which we remain cognitively intact. So, you know, promoting brain health, you know, I think has become a really important issue with COVID, with obesity, with insulin resistance. So as we said, intermittent fasting and a real food diet is this place to start. You want to tell us about some other interventions or to promote brain health? So what should we be thinking about to promote brain health?
Well, one other thing I wanted to mention about the intermittent fasting is I follow a Mark Madison. He's a researcher at the Institute of Aging. And he said once that if everyone implemented intermittent fasting at middle age, he said we could prevent and certainly reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, et cetera. And I think if that statement doesn't speak to how incredibly important this is to start early, to make it a lifestyle, to encourage this, go on with life. But yes, I think the pillars of health in brain recovery or brain health are diet, intermittent fasting, exercise, of course. Exercise, as I mentioned, is like healthy Miracle-Gro. Not that Miracle-Gro is healthy, but healthy Miracle-Gro for the brain. It too increases BDNF. It helps heal the blood-brain barrier. It helps our neurons to connect better. And of course, it improves metabolic health, vascular health as well. You know, what kind of exercise is really the question, right? You know, I think if you can do HIIT, like Christina, I'm sure does, high intensity intermittent training, that's very helpful. But as you get older, I don't know if that's really doable. Probably for some people it is. But I'm telling you, just walking, just put your tennis shoes on and go out and walk around the block or walk a few miles, get your steps in. It's not, you don't necessarily need to join a gym. Although we do believe that implementing some kind of strength training two or three times a week, and that can easily be done at home. So that's number three. Number four is sleep. No, when we sleep, as you mentioned, circadian rhythm, but sleep is when our lymphatic system, again, the garbage truck that comes in and cleans out all the stuff that got in our brain that wasn't supposed to, the lymphatic system is activated. And people that don't sleep, somebody once said, well, I'll sleep when I'm dead. And, you know, really, you will die sooner. It is a risk factor for early death, cardiovascular disease, and of course, dementia. So improve sleep. Now you got to make sure you don't have sleep apnea. We don't want you having hypoxia at night. And the other thing about the lymphatic system, there was a study published in 2023 that SARS-CoV-2, and it's again, we say probably spike protein, shuts down the lymphatic system. So again, it's more important than ever to upregulate that with a good quality sleep. So that's the next.
Suzanne, do you want to tell us about how long you should sleep for? Because there are people who, you know, say, oh, I can get, you know, get away with 4 or 5 hours of sleep and I feel fine. But the literature doesn't support that concept. Would you agree that it seems you need at least for an adult, at least 7 to 8 hours of high quality sleep to restore the glymphatic system to, you know, restore neuronal function?
That is absolutely right, Paul. Yeah, we need a good 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And taking a nap in the afternoon to catch up, it doesn't work. And there was actually a study, I'll have to find it and I'll put it in the show notes, but the study showed that people that are nappers have more cognitive issues. So again, good quality sleep. Okay, if you want to take a nap for 30 minutes for rest in the afternoon, but it is nighttime sleep that is truly what we need most.
Yeah, so nighttime is for sleeping. So people should, you know, stay awake during the day and try and sleep at night. That's the way it was meant to be. And there are certain ways that you can improve sleep hygiene. You know, don't have television in your room. Don't have bright lights in your room. Don't have a computer in your room. You know, a you know, a bedroom is for sleeping, not for entertainment. And so that one should be cognizant of bright lights, which disturb the circadian rhythm. You know, if you want to, you can put red lights in your room at bedtime, which have less of an effect on disturbing your melatonin cycle. So there are certain things you can do to promote health, healthy sleep.
No doubt, people that have chronic insomnia are, I mean, that's a whole hour consult all on its own, trying to remedy chronic insomnia. But it takes a lot of work. But I think if we address what might be driving that, it certainly, these people certainly can be helped without sleep meds. Because although I'm not telling people not to get on a sleep med, I'd rather you take something if that helps you sleep. But we also know that there are some medications, including some of the sleep meds, that really inhibit brain health. So it's a catch 22. Do I take this and get a good 6 or 7 hours of sleep? Or do I struggle and lay there? No, something's got to be done. So yes, I agree. And then Paul, the next pillar in the low hanging fruit is stress. We live such stressful lives. It's like it becomes just the way it should be. But isn't it now what they say? Stress is about smoking a pack a day, about it's equivalent, because stress drives cortisol. Cortisol drives inflammation, and high levels of inflammation are detrimental to the body and brain. So mind-body wellness, yoga, tai chi, if you need to, talk to someone. But this has been a stressful last 4 years, no doubt, probably the neuropsychiatric impact of the pandemic. We have comparison.
People don't recognize, you know, acute stress is fine because that's how the body was designed. But, you know, this chronic stress response and, you know, being chronically stressed results in prolonged cortisol, high blood glucose, insulin resistance. So, high catecholamine. So it does create this terrible cycle. So, you know, management of stress is really important. So, you know, Christina will be quite happy if I mention this. So, you know, there are stress reduction techniques, meditation, a thing called yoga. I'm not sure what it is, but you can do yoga, you know, whatever you can to reduce stress. And, you know, I think people need to focus on these simple interventions. This is not complicated stuff. This is eating good food. This is restricting how frequently you eat, good sleep, exercise, and stress reduction. This is pretty basic in terms of lifestyle intervention.
No, for sure. And I think the last thing I would say is neuroplasticity. Never go to bed at night without learning 3 new things. And most people that are working are learning new things every day. But for people that already have a mild cognitive impairment or dementia, it's a very important part of our recovery protocol is to implement something. Socialization, loneliness is certainly going to increase risk of dementia. And that certainly was a problem during the pandemic when elderly people were not allowed to get out and about. And then the last thing I would say would be some targeted key supplements. Really, this isn't a bunch of mumbo jumbo. There's a lot of science behind it. I would say, first of all, make sure your vitamin D level is healthy for a lot of reasons. I say it should be above 60, 60 to 120. And you want to use the D3 K2. K2 is also a fat-soluble vitamin. It's also beneficial for the brain and the heart. It, of course, helps the D3 better absorbed. Check your B12 level. I think vitamin B complex or B vitamins are really critical in people with dementia for a lot of reasons. Mitochondrial support. I love acetyl-carnitine. There are many others. All of the flavonoids, we love at the FLCCC, we love resveratrol and the great blue wonder.
So, Suzanne, is there not really good data showing that resveratrol actually attenuates or can prevent dementia? So this is really, you know, this is, we're not just paying lip service. You know, there's really good data. Now, obviously, there are hundreds of supplements out there. So, you know, so one has to be somewhat selective in, you know, getting the most bang for your buck. So, you know, I agree with you. I think vitamin D is crucial. You know, I think, you know, there's good data, vitamin D in diabetes, in dementia, in depression, in cancer. So I think vitamin D, you know, everyone should take vitamin D. And then obviously, and together with vitamin K2. And then what do you think of melatonin?
I love it. To me, melatonin is like a cushion for the brain. It's great at reducing oxidative stress, increases BDNF. I mean, yes, it can improve sleep, but it's more those other restorative functions that melatonin offers. I do include it in my protocols. I think it's important for someone that's suffering with cognitive impairment, worried about their the cognitive decline, if it's a them or their family member. It's very important to try to find a practitioner that understands this whole protocol, this whole teaching method. And there aren't very many people.
Would you agree that it's really important to start this early in, you know, in the early phases of cognitive decline? You don't want it to progress because I think it becomes more difficult to reverse. So, you know, at the very onset of, you know, when people notice that, you know, they have some kind of brain fog, their memory is not good, or, the, you know, the memory is not as sharp as it used to be, that's the time, you know, to intervene rather than wait for it to progress. Would you agree with that?
Oh, totally. Yeah. But, and I'm not putting a plug in for this, but I learned about this by studying something called the Bredesen protocol. Dale Bredesen is a neurologist. He's about my age, who became very frustrated with trying to take care of Alzheimer's patients and just watching them get worse. And you know, the research that he has done and his publication, he has actually reversed dementia. Now you have to do everything right. The lifestyle, the diet, the intermittent fasting, the optimizing sleep, and other things. But if anyone out there is looking for a practitioner to help them with cognitive recovery, look, go to their website and look for practitioners that are taking patients.
Okay, so we've covered the general basis. You know, are there other supplements or nutraceuticals you would recommend? What about magnesium, for example? And does the type of magnesium make a difference?
Paul, I think we're all deficient in magnesium. And magnesium is such an important nutrient for neurotransmitters, many, many other things. For brain, I like magnesium glycinate or magnesium threonate. They're both very well absorbed. They both cross the blood-brain barrier. So those are the two that I particularly use and usually give them at bedtime.
Yeah, so I think that's an important point because most of the time if you go to the pharmacy, you buy magnesium, or it's called higher potency magnesium, it's magnesium sulfate. And the absorption is terrible, and it doesn't get into the brain. So I think what Dr. Guzda said is really important, that, you know, you should get threonate or glycinate because it's been shown to, you know, improve CNS levels of magnesium. And the bioabsorption of the magnesium sulfate or magnesium chloride is really poor.
Absolutely. And I think that, of course, we can't forget the herbs that have been around for 1,000 years or more. I love ashwagandha. I love lion's mane. It increases nerve growth factor. I like ginkgo biloba. You can buy it over the counter. It decreases glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter. So all of these things have so much. I'm going to talk about a lot of these at the conference during my lecture, but we'll focus on the ones that I think would be most beneficial for brain health as we're going forward from 2020 on.
What do you think about photobiomodulation for dementia or preventing dementia?
It's absolutely almost magical. And I'll talk about this too in the conference. If you have dementia, it is very possible that doing all of these things will not be enough. So like you said, gosh, I'm going to do everything I can so that I can continue to live at home. I continue to take care of myself, et cetera. I mean, quality of life is really where we're at, but photobiomodulation, it can profoundly improve cognitive function, increase cerebral blood flow, improve neuronal mitochondrial function. I've had patients that on a type of MRI we do called a neuroquant have low gray matter. I mean, that's bad. They're already in irreversible land. And of course, doing all of these things, but it was the photobiomodulation that brought the gray matter back. So we can restore neuronal function again if we do everything right.
Yeah. So just so people understand what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, photobiomodulation. So we're talking about basically these devices that emit infrared, and infrared light then penetrates through the skull and quite deeply into the cortex. And it has numerous effects. One of them is to improve mitochondrial function, electron transport. And so there's pretty good data on the use of photobiomodulation for, you know, traumatic brain injury, post-stroke. So it does seem to have a significant effect on improving brain function.
Definitely. I'm not plugging. I don't get any kickback, or believe me, I don't. The two devices that I'll talk about at the conference that have the most research for brain health are called Violite, and the other is Origin. And I'll show you pictures of those at the conference and show you how we recommend using them, because they target the default mode network, which is that network, frontal executive function and the hippocampus. So definitely so much science, not just for brain, not just dementia, but for traumatic brain injury as well.
Yeah. So I think the bottom line is that dementia is not it's not one of those things that is part of aging. One can age without losing cognitive function, and that the things one can do to limit one's risk of developing dementia and maintaining cognitive health. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I love the way you put that. When people come in and they say, well, it's just me getting older. No, we should have vibrantly good memories until the day we die.
Yeah.
I like to hear this. This is good. This is good stuff. We have a lot of questions. Can I jump in here with a whole bunch of them? And I have to tell you, one of them is one that I have, and so does Paul Sheridan. And that is, what should the ratio of eating and not eating hours be? Assuming I will be comfortable, Paul asks, with being hungry, how long of a fasting period is really necessary?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think it's very flexible and adaptable, and that you can vary it from day to day. So I've perfected it to the point that I can eat one meal a day. And so I think our forefathers ate one or two meals a day. So I think optimally you want to have an eating window of between 2 to 4 hours. But, you know, even 6 hours is okay, or 8 hours is okay. There's certain things that you don't want to do. You don't want to eat within a few hours of going to sleep, because that switches off your glymphatic, switches off autophagy while you're sleeping. So having a big meal and then going to sleep is a bad thing. Optimally, you know, it's not that difficult, actually. It's that we become addicted to eating. We become addicted to glucose. And once you break that addiction, it's actually not that difficult to do. This is the way our forefathers, you know, we would go hunting and you would eat one or two meals a day. You didn't have a 7-Eleven up the road and you wouldn't eat and snack all the time. So this is a maladaptive behavior that we've developed. You know, what happens is the more you snack, the more insulin resistant you become, the more hungrier you are. So it creates this vicious cycle. And once you break the vicious cycle, it's actually not that difficult. So I think, you know, as Dr. Guzzo says, there are two things. The first is high quality food. So, I mean, I think that's really important, is that you want to eat real food and you want to have at least, particularly overnight, you know, miss breakfast. You know, missing breakfast is not difficult. So, you know, if you have to eat two meals a day, you can, you know, skip breakfast and have your first meal at 12 o'clock.
You certainly don't need a dozen donuts. I mean, this is the wrong American kind of way to start the day.
Absolutely. So, you know, what you say is a good thing. I think donuts and bagels are probably the worst things to eat, the worst things for glycemic control. And it seems to be part of the staple Western diet. You start off the meal, you know, the day with donuts and bagel. That's the worst thing to do. So you start off the day with coffee. That's fine. And just leave it at that.
And sugary cereals are the same thing. You know, they're
Sugary cereals aren't food, actually, Betsy. It's some kind of a synthetic chemical compound which was derived to be toxic to the brain. It's not a food. It's not a food source. It doesn't grow on a tree.
There are interesting questions because some of our people are concerned about fasting because of weight loss. And have the question of, you know, some say they lose too much weight when doing intermittent fasting and keto. What would be suggested for longer term once you are healthy?
Yes, I think once you reach a stable weight, you should still eat the same amount of calories, but you eat within, you have two meals a day, you know, and you can, within those two meals, you can take in sufficient calories so that you don't lose weight. So this is not starvation. You know, there's a big difference between intermittent fasting and starving. We're not starving the body. It's very important. So you can take in sufficient calories and high quality food if you eat, you know, twice a day.
And here's the opposite question, it seems, from Mitch B. Says, how do you not gain weight with fasting? How many calories do we need to have? And do we need to have no carbs or sugar to lose weight? Well, we've already talked about the sugar, yes. But maybe you want to elaborate on that for him?
Yeah, so I mean, by doing intermittent fasting, you know, it depends what your goal is. I think for many of us, you know, who are overweight, it is an efficient way of slowly losing weight. And it's probably the most efficient way of losing weight. Diets simply don't work because it has to be a lifestyle change. And so that's why you can adapt it according to what your goals are. Do you need to lose weight or do you want to maintain weight? And certainly by intermittent fasting, the remarkable thing is that once you break this vicious cycle, you lose the cravings for carbohydrates and processed food. So it's actually not that difficult to do. Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a question again about the fasting. It says, this is from Sally Clark, who says, I am using intermittent fasting. Typically, I just eat in the evening. Despite this, every mid-afternoon, I get an episode of extreme fatigue while at my desk. This usually passes in about 30 minutes. But can this be addressed? I'm overweight and menopausal, age 52.
Yeah, so it's probably best. I mean, the optimal time to have a meal is probably, between 2 and 3 o'clock. So, you know, if she's only eating late at the night, I would suggest having a small meal of high quality food, you know, early in the afternoon, and you know, see how that goes. So I think, you know, the thing about intermittent fasting is very flexible. There's no one way to do it. And you can adapt it to your work routine, your lifestyle so that it's most compatible and easiest to follow.
And you don't have to be totally carb free. We've got a question from people who call themselves the Happy Hoofers. They're on Rumble, and they're saying, will intermittent fasting be ineffective if one doesn't eat totally or is mostly carb free?
So I think what's probably more important, because as Dr. Gunster said in the diet in mice, the mice were fed the same diet, but they were fed during a restricted period. So I think that the first step is to have some period of fasting. The second is to try and improve the quality of the food you eat. So try and limit the amount of processed foods. I think that's really important. So you want to have a fasting window, and then you want to try and improve the quality of the food that you eat. So, I mean, ideally, you want to eat real food, not processed food. And the problem with processed food is it causes, you know, has a very high glycemic index, you get a high blood glucose, high insulin levels.
All right. Here's another question. We have a lot of questions on the fasting, obviously. A question from someone who says, is intermittent fasting advisable for people who've had their gallbladder removed? They are recommended to eat smaller, more frequent meals due to bile that is constantly entering the colon.
Yeah, no, I don't know if Suzanne thinks differently. I think you if you've had a cholecystectomy, I think it's fine. You know, you just eat to tolerance and just, you know, see what works for you. But this idea of eating all the time is completely unphysiologic. We weren't built and evolved to eat that way.
All right. Now let's go to some of the good questions about. Here's another one. Is fasting from Ellen? Says, is fasting for 10, 12, or 16 hours enough to help clear spike protein, or are longer fasts needed for that?
Yeah, so that is a good question. We're not sure the optimal duration. There are some people that will do a more prolonged fast intermittently. So they'll do intermittent fasting, and then they may have a 2 or 3 day fast where they just drink liquids. And that may be required if you have a high spike load. We don't know that. It is a really good question. You know, I know that Pierre, you know, you heard of Pierre Corey. That's what Pierre does every now and then. He does a more prolonged fast because he's got a lot of toxins to get rid of. So he finds it, you know, quite therapeutic. But it is a good question. We're not sure the optimal duration of fast to help get rid of protein. Do you have any idea, Dr. Gazda?
I really don't.
We have a lot of people interested. And here's one for you, Dr. Gazda. On that, Janice Wells says, can you speak to what types of food and how much protein to eat during the period that you do eat?
Well, that's the challenge, right? It's recommended that we eat 1 gram per pound of protein. It's a lot of protein, right? And as we age, we lose muscle mass. So I think it is important to make sure we're optimizing the protein level in our diet. Of course, the diet is low inflammatory, non-GMO, real food, really, not thoughtless food, which is what I call the other food. So what I do in order to get that amount of protein with my fasting is I use a plant-based protein powder. The one I use is called Kachava. I learned about it from an ALS group because those patients have horrible muscle mass loss and protein loss. So in a scoop of Kachava that I put in my smoothie, coconut water, et cetera, it has about 25 grams of protein. So I'll put 2 scoops in there. So I'm already now at 50 grams. And then with the other protein I get in my other meals, I think I get there. So I think that is something people do need to think about and consider.
Yeah, so I do like cassava. You know, coincidentally, Dr. Gazda, I have some in my kitchen just because it's high quality protein. It also has, you know, many nutraceuticals in it. So I think it's a high quality protein mix that is a complete meal, mm-hmm. and is a high quality protein.
Here's a question for Dr. Gazda from Marie Peruzzi, who says, a neurologist told a friend with migraines, not too fast, as it can make migraines worse. Is this true? Not too fast, not too fast, as in eating too fast, but not too fast.
Well, certainly migraines can be provoked by different things. But I would say in this day and age, that's a myth. Now, of course, I would tell everyone to see how they feel on an individual basis, but it's probably something else that is triggering the migraine. But, you know, so many people say, I can't fast because I get hypoglycemic, right, Paul? And they say, I can't do that. I feel my blood pressure drop. And how am I going to go to the gym and work out? But, you know, once you regulate this, your system, it shouldn't be happening. Actually, your glucose should be better control. Do you agree, Paul?
Absolutely. So the fact that you can't fast means that you're metabolically dysregulated. And so you need to have the discipline to try and break the cycle, because it is the natural way that we designed to eat for a while and to fast for a while. That's the way the body's designed. And if you can't do that, then you are metabolically dysfunctional and you need to try and become, you know, restore your metabolic function.
Yes.
We have some questions about bad cholesterol. Here's Deborah Vanderob says, my bad cholesterol, the LDL, I presume, is high. I'd like to do intermittent fasting instead of using statins. Will that work?
Yeah. So, you know, the whole cholesterol thing is somewhat of a myth. High cholesterol doesn't cause coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is due to inflammation. So in most patients, intermittent fasting does cause the cholesterol to go down and the LDL to go down. There are a few patients in who it goes up, but generally what's important is the ratio of triglycerides to LDL. And generally, intermittent fasting has a favorable effect on the lipid profile. So statins do not prevent coronary disease. They have enormous side effect profile. One of them is dementia. Is this not correct, Dr. DeGazda? It depletes, you know, because the brain has a lot of cholesterol and it's required for cellular function. And one of the adverse effects of statins is cognitive decline. Is this not correct, Dr. Gazda?
Absolutely. We go round and round with the cardiologist. I saw a patient the other day with brain fog whose cholesterol level was 90. And she was on a statin. And you can't argue with the cardiologist. You just can't. So absolutely, the brain is about 70% fat. It needs good quality fat, including our own cholesterol.
I'm going through this right now. That's so much fun talking to the cardiologist. Oh, statins are a great thing. I said, yeah, really. Yeah. Anyway, that's fun. You answered a question. Jacqueline Penskin thanks you because she wanted to know more about whether or not the statins initiated cognitive decline. Now, here's someone, a viewer, says, I work in pediatric and adolescent medicine. What are the intermittent fasting recommendations for a growing child?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So, you know, I think I would not do intermittent fasting in a growing child. What I would do rather is focus on high quality food. I think that's more important, that they need to be fed. and that intermittent fasting is generally not recommended in children. You know, maybe as you're getting towards adolescence, maybe, but I think in children, what one should focus on is teaching them to eat high quality foods. I think that is just so important. And breakfast cereals and processed foods and bagels and donuts should be removed from the house. But these are hidden toxins. And I think that's probably the most important is to raise kids understanding what a healthy diet is. How do you feel about that, Dr. Gazda?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is a crisis. The food that our children are fed in schools and that they have learned that they must have and eat. I would also add, Marina Zhang wrote a beautiful article posted in Epoch Health today on reducing screen time, the amount of time that kids, young adults, everybody really spends on their phone or on social media or playing video games is very destructive to brain health, increases the risk of ADHD, and of course, affects our ability to think cognitively as well as our mood. So I'd encourage everybody to take a peek at that as well.
Carl Pine wants to know, does heavy cream in coffee in the morning mess up intermittent fasting? I drink 2 or 3 cups with heavy cream.
Yeah, no, heavy cream is fine. Christina has a bullet coffee that you can look at. She has her own recipe that she's come up with. So bullet coffee with heavy cream is fine.
That's really nice to know. By the way, someone asked if we had a kind of find it here. If we had a yes, here we go. Jacqueline Eisenberg wants to know, is there a guide that the FLCCC has for intermittent fasting? Yes. And yes. We pasted the link to the FLCCC guide in the chat. Paul, tell them about that.
Yeah, so we have multiple guides in the section on protocols and guides. So there is Christina has developed a number of infographics. She's posted one on the bullet coffee, but we do have a guide to intermittent fasting. And then obviously, you know, if people want to do some more reading, the book by Jason Fung is really, you know, his outstanding book that they should read. And then obviously, you know, there's the question of intermittent fasting and menstrual cycle. And so some women, you know, may have to adapt intermittent fasting to the menstrual cycle. And so that's something to think about. I saw a question about stevia with coffee. Stevia is fine in coffee because it doesn't mess up your glycemic load.
Even though it gives you a little bit of sweetener. It's
Yes.
Is the same true with coconut?
Stevia has actually been shown to improve glycemic control and in of itself it has, effects on diabetes.
I would have to disagree with, from a brain standpoint, the NutraSweet from stevia to all of the artificial sweeteners, there is data going back 30 years of how toxic they are to the brain. So I don't recommend them in someone that's trying to optimize brain health.
Stevia?
Mm-hmm. As well, yes.
Okay. Marguerite Fleury asks, when is it not advisable to do intermittent fasting and or calorie restriction?
Yeah, so there are a few conditions. I think type 1 diabetics have to be really careful. And so the approach is completely different. So if you're a type 1 diabetic, you know, you can't do intermittent fasting. And then obviously someone who's really underweight or malnourished, you don't want to do intermittent fasting. Pregnancy is not recommended. You know, you want to maintain a good, healthy diet, but not to do intermittent fasting. I think those are probably the major exceptions. Would you agree, Dr. Gazda?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Betsy, and on the NutraSweet, I have an article on my website, a blog that I wrote sometime last year. If people want to refer to that, Suzanne Gazda, MD, you can find my website.
Okay. Now, NutraSweet is something totally different from stevia, though. That's a manufactured thing. Because I remember when that came out, I was at CBS News. That's the aspartame one, right?
Yeah, but none of them come from nature. So I think they're...
Stevia is a leaf in South America, from a plant in South America.
Well, I'll look at the research on that again and let me get this group about that.
I'd like to know it because I have stevia in the house.
So stevia, like, maybe, you know, stevia may be an exception because, as you say, it is a natural leaf, but we'll do some additional research on stevia. The other ones, certainly I wouldn't take. Stevia may be the exception, but you know what? We're always here to learn. So
let's learn. I want to learn. That's good. Okay.
We'll do some more research.
Well, we're at the top of the hour. Do we have time for a couple more?
Sure.
Okay. Now here's one about the methylene blue for Dr. Gazda. It says, well, first of all, we know you like methylene blue for neuroinflammation, right? When I take a low dose of methylene blue, 10 milligrams daily, I get so terribly dizzy for 3 hours afterwards. Do you think this could be caused by a sudden reduction in neuroinflammation?
I doubt it works that fast, but I would definitely recommend you alter your dose to a dose where you're not experiencing that. I mean, you can get effects with low dose, even 3 milligrams, 3 to 4 milligrams. Ideally, we like to get to 10 to 30 milligrams, but I have some patients that do exceptionally well on lower doses than that.
Yeah, and then maybe do it twice a day. Instead of taking 10 milligrams once, you know, do 5 or 3 milligrams twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, being dizzy for 3 hours does not strike me as a fun thing. I mean, here's a question about, for Dr. Gazda, what are your thoughts on using old drugs like memantine and amlexinox for neuroinflammation caused by vaccine injury? I don't know if I pronounced those words right. Memantine.
So it's an old drug that came out for treatment of moderate to severe dementia, Alzheimer's disease. But I do like using it because it blocks glutamate. Glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter that is probably involved in a lot of the brain injury with spike protein, either long COVID or vaccine injury. So it's very, very, very safe. Doses 5 to 10 milligrams twice a day. The other drug, I'm not sure I recognize.
Amlexinox, A-M-L-E-X-A-N-O-X.
Amlexinox. That one's got me stumped. I don't know that one. I'm sorry.
All right. And let me see where we are.
I also just wrote a blog on what are the best things to do to block glutamate, and that should be posted on my website today. Glutamate, high levels of glutamate are also involved in migraine, and that sometimes using glutamate blockers, and there are many, many natural products that can help with glutamate reduction. Please look at that if you get a chance.
Yeah, Betsy, I mean, Dr. Gazda is just such a source of information. So
it's wonderful.
I just want to, you know, put another plug in for Dr. Gazda will be one of our guest speakers at the conference. Yes. And so you want to see her live.
Absolutely.
She's really good live.
Absolutely. Now, here, a couple more here. Will intermittent fasting help with an essential tremor since it is a neurological disorder?
I would definitely implement it. Essential tremor is probably related to neuroinflammation, alteration of neurotransmitters. It could be an early sign of a neurodegenerative disease. We see a lot of tremor these days, post-COVID and post-vaccine. It's the most common movement disorder that we are seeing. It's subtle in most people, But definitely intermittent fasting for your health, your wellness, your brain health, whatever your symptoms are, is definitely something worth implementing in your lifestyle.
Donna Bassett would like to know if you have any thoughts on the carnivore diet, fasting as much easier when eating fatty meats and eggs.
Paul?
Yeah, so I think there's nothing wrong with high quality meat and eggs. So, you know, I think an egg provides an enormous, is enormously powerful and spectrum of amino acids and a high quality protein. So, you know, there was a big push against eggs. I think eggs are fine. Eggs are really a good source of protein for children. So instead of giving them, you know, processed cereals, which are just chemicals, I think an egg is a really good source of protein.
Right. Here's a good question from Beth Jackson. Do you dive in and do intermittent fasting all the way or just start gradually?
Start gradually. Like most things in life, you want to ease into it and, you know, you figure it out. So I think you want to start slowly and build up your duration of fasting.
Here's another one you're going to like, Paul. Someone from Rumble says, how much does intermittent fasting slow cancer growth or even reverse it, if it does?
Yeah, it does. So, there's no question that a ketotic diet is really important in dealing with most of the attributes of cancer. So it is the metabolic foundation of treating cancer is a ketotic diet. And that can be quite effectively achieved with intermittent fasting. So yes, there is really good data. And surprisingly, it actually acts synergistically with conventional chemotherapy. So chemotherapy becomes significantly more effective if combined with a intermittent fasting or ketotic diet.
And Susan Beckham wants to know, could Dr. Gazda give us a little more information about ashwagandha, please?
It's one of my favorite herbs. It has been shown, of course, all of this is animal data, to reduce amyloid beta prion that's prominent in neurodegenerative disease or Alzheimer's disease. It reduces microglial cell activation, i.e. neuroinflammation, and it can improve mood. So benefits for cognitive health and psychiatric benefits as well. It's extremely safe. I think the dose, I'll have to make sure I've got it on my website, but I think it's 500 milligrams twice a day.
And here's a question from Laurie. Says, Northern elderberry, indica, the gummies with CBD can help with sleep, but do they increase your chances of Alzheimer's?
I don't think so. I think that's a good recommendation if the CBD is clean and organic. But if it is, then I think that's a great option for a sleep aid.
Better than melatonin?
Well, I don't know. I mean, melatonin doesn't help that many people sleep. It sometimes, I'll say if I ask 100 people, I'd say maybe 10 of them, oh yeah, that really helps me sleep. But it's the benefit of melatonin for brain health is why we strongly recommend it in at least my protocols.
And now this is a little bit on a different tack, but Prabha Agost says, hey, Dr. Merrick, do you have a motorcycle to go with that sassy jacket?
Christina has the motorcycle. We're working on it.
Well, folks, we could go on all night.
Betsy, the story about the jacket is that you can get it from the FLCC store. It's right. It's our motorcycle jacket from the FLCC store. Thanks, Zach.
Absolutely. Well, we thank you both for all of this work and for taking the time to share it with us. And you'll be at the conference, which is wonderful, wonderful to know. So thank you for being here. We will see you soon in Phoenix. And you know, and I'm sure we'll have you back too, because this is a topic that is not going to stop ever. It's what you said about the post-vaccine and post-COVID brain changes is very, very disturbing. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing from fellow neurologists that this is the same kind of thing?
Yes. Yes, everyone is overwhelmed. I think my next opening is in August. There's at least an 8 to 9 month wait now to get in to see a neurologist, you know. So we are overwhelmed, and a lot of it is cognitive decline.
Oh, my word. My word. Well.
But
well, Betsy, I think
that's things we can do.
Yeah, that's really a call to action now, that people must do what they need to do so they don't need to see Dr. Gazda. And so there are
it's too busy.
Yeah, so there are many things people can do to, you know, work on their cognitive health so that they don't decline to the point that they need to see Dr. Gazda.
You're here.
Well, our goal is to keep it, is to try to get out of business.
Thank you both for being here and sharing all of this good information. I have a few announcements for you folks who are watching. Don't go away. And we have a wonderful video at the very end to show you a wonderful My Story, which is, you have to watch this, Paul, because you know it's your work primarily that people are saying, oh, how wonderful, how absolutely wonderful. So folks, one of the things we need to tell you about is upcoming webinars. We are, of course, delighted that you were here with us tonight, but we hope you'll be here next week too, because we will have a discussion on an alternative approach to cancer. And that, of course, is what Dr. Marek has worked on studying for months and putting together a monograph that's just very impressive here. And we will have a special guest with him, well-known cancer surgeon and author, Dr. Kathleen Ruddy, for that. And same time, same place, next week right here. Now then, the following week, January 31st, there will be no webinar because we will all be flying to Phoenix for the third FLCCC Educational Conference. And we'll be back here the following week after the conference. We will give you highlights. We will show you videos. We will tell you a lot of what we have learned from the good doctors like Dr. Ruddy, Dr. Gazda, that are going to be presenting there, and from a lot of the community spirit that I think is going to happen there as well. So we will give you the highlights the week after. Anyway, now, speaking of the conference, yes, the countdown is 16 days to go until we kick it off, the healthcare revolution. And as I said, both Dr. Gazda, Dr. Marek, Dr. Ruddy will be featured speakers, along with many other experts from a variety of fields. The focus of the conference is a little different. As you may have heard in our opening video, the goal is to help empower patients to take control of their health and to help connect like-minded individuals and to help restore the doctor-patient relationship. You can learn more or register today at flccc.net/conference. And please make sure to book your hotel room by this Friday, as the discounted rate at Hyatt Place, Phoenix, which is only about a mile away from the conference and offers free shuttle service there, it expires then. That's Friday. And rooms are filling up very quickly. Now then, that we have an Alzheimer's guide. This is something, in the meantime, you can get this guide for everyone concerned about Alzheimer's. It covers causes, symptoms, progression, and treatment, as well as health foods, supplements, and lifestyle changes that can help support precious brain health, what we were talking about tonight. You will find that on our website under the Tools and Guides tab or at the link on the screen. And do pass this along to all of your friends, to anybody that you know in the family who may be interested or in need of these helpful tips. Now, we have a new episode of Long Story Short from the incredible Dr. Bean, sharing an article from the University of Cambridge in which researchers found flaws in mRNA therapeutics not surprising, but concerning nevertheless, with implications for current and future therapeutics. You can watch it now on our FLCCC Alliance Rumble and Odyssey channels or on our website at flccc.net/Dr. Bean. And with that, let's bring on Christina Maros, the bomber jacket queen, CRNA also, and RN. We've got Samantha Hanks, who is, they've been answering your questions all evening, and I have a feeling you've been flooded.
We have been flooded. It's no doubt. But I want to call people's attention to our intermittent fasting guide and our tools and guides section. We have loads of information on intermittent fasting, on ashwagandha, on brain health, on magnesium. People can learn a lot if they go and search our website.
Wonderful. Wonderful to have it there. And you've been working on putting all these things together. Thank you. Thank you, both of you, for all that you do here and help. You know, people need to, there's so much to learn. There's just so much to learn and to keep it all together. So you are wonderful. And we'll see you in Phoenix too, which is going to be fun. Thank you. Now then, thank you. That is the one thing we have to say, because each and every one of you, for joining us tonight, for supporting us along the way, for sharing your stories, your words of encouragement, for helping spread the word, for supporting what we do. And, you know, you make all of this possible. So thank you, FLCCC family. We will see you next week, as I said, but we're going to leave you with, oh, we have a little short video of the conference, but that one great My Story from Dan, who shared an amazing story about what our doctor's work, Paul's, Pierre's, and the rest of the doctors, has meant to him and his wife. You don't want to miss Dan's story. Take a look. We'll see you next week.
The goal of all of this is just central to what we do. I mean, we're trying to help patients.
This is the battle to restore medicine to its original purpose.
This is the population of people that is creating a functional healthcare system parallel to the healthcare system that has failed us.
Hi, I'm Dan. I am a longtime reader of the FLCCC, and I cannot overstate just how important the information has been to myself, family, and friends. I sourced ivermectin from India, and this has saved many friends and their families from severe COVID problems. Most were healed within 1 to 2 days, and one person who was very ill, yet when he took the ivermectin, he went back to work on the morning of day 3. Just amazing stories, especially when you consider just how ill some people were feeling prior to starting to take the ivermectin. We live in Utah and regretfully bought into the government's vaccination stories initially, based on information provided by howbadismybatch.com. My wife and myself received some of the worst batches produced. My wife, Kathy, had her second dose on April 6th, 2021. I had my second dose 2 days later. 8 weeks after receiving her second dose, Kathy experienced a major heart attack. Kathy survived, but after her heart attack, I started doing loads of reading and investigating, leading me to understand how important ivermectin is in fighting COVID. So we finally wised up and decided not to receive any further vaccinations. A year and a half later, in December 2022, after moving snow with a snowblower, I started experiencing very severe heart pain. I ended up going to the local ER. They did their workup and said I was not having a heart attack, but thought that there were problems based on the EKG readings. They released me from the hospital that afternoon. This angina continued, and I ended up going back to the emergency room 3 days later. They did not find any blockages. They did say my arteries were the equivalent of someone who was 15 years old. However, I am 64 years old and weigh 170 pounds. I continued experiencing heart pain and breathing problems and got a second opinion. That second angiogram again showed no problems. Immediately after, I started rereading your website again and came across the vaccine injury protocol. It's said to use ivermectin for a 2 to 3 week trial, and if successful, follow it up with a higher dose. So I started using the low dose ivermectin in an attempt to stop the heart and breathing problems. It worked immediately that very first day. After a couple weeks, I increased my ivermectin dose to the recommended full dose, which I continue to take to this day. Your protocol has dramatically improved my life, and in fact, it may have saved my life. Two different cardiologists were not able to identify the heart and lung problem I have been experiencing for several months. And then after following your vaccine injury protocol, all of my heart and breathing problems have completely disappeared. It's absolutely amazing. I cannot thank you enough for your help and your guidance. Thank you.